If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Then we were threatened, and then I was attacked, not once, but twice by two men, one wielding a knife. And after defending myself and the police arrive, I was arrested and charged without any investigation or due process. And it took me through literally over 26 months of hell to get through it. And then another 5.5 years to clear my name and get the whole record sealed, in somewhere between $600,000 and $750,000 in legal fees and costs. That's it in a nutshell. When you read the story, what I realized through this whole thing was you're no longer innocent until proven guilty in this country. You are now presumed guilty.
Hey, gang. Welcome back to this week's edition of Game of Crimes with Murphy in the Morning. I about forgot the name of my own show here, and I've only been doing this for 5 years now. Holy cow. Could it be my age? I think so. But listen, thank you guys so much for coming back every week. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And this week, I brought in another great guest, a little bit different from what we usually bring in, but it's equally as important as everything else that we talk about here on Game of Crimes. Today's guest is a true American hero. He gave 21 years of his life to the U.S. Army. He was in the Rangers, which that translates to the tough guys. All right. And retired out of the Army as a captain. And we're going to get into his career a little bit. But ladies and gentlemen, it's my honor to welcome today's guest, Mr. Barry Todd. Barry, welcome to Game of Crime, sir.
Thank you, sir. And thank you for having me. It's an honor.
It's an honor to have you on here. I bring on a lot of first responders and military folks. Occasionally, we bring on former bad guys. But for somebody that serves their country for as many years as you did, in my book, that makes you a hero.
Well, I appreciate it. I have never been called that. And if I have, I don't remember it. And I try to ignore it. But I do appreciate it. It was an honor to serve. And coming from the lineage that I come from, it was almost a requirement. I won't say it was, but that's the way our family leaned and still leans to this day.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, normally we have a section in here we call the small town police blotter, but I'm going to forgo that today in this week's episode, just simply because the issues we're going to talk about today are not funny. I mean, they're usually not funny. Correct. When we're talking about people getting shot and sacrificing their lives and things like that. But I want to get right into it. First of all, how I met Barry was his publicist, a member of his team. And that's Miss Lori from LR Media. She reached out to me and told me about Barry and his story. And I got to be real honest with you. And I told Barry this too. I was skeptical at first. And so they sent me a copy of his book. And we're going to talk about that later. And I'll tell you where to get it. But this is his book, Stand Your Ground. And that right there should give you a clue as to what we're going to talk about today when we finally get to it here. But I read the book. And I was about halfway through and I was talking to my wife about it, Connie, and I said, you know, I'm not sure that this is going to fit in. But then when I finished the book, like Paul Harvey says, I got the rest of the story. Like, yeah, it fits right in here on Game of Crimes. Because, you know, we hold our first responders and our military to a higher standard, right? Yes. Because they are public servants. And don't think that term is derogatory, because it's not. There's no greater calling that a man or a woman serves their fellow men and women. I mean,
amen.
And I'm not going to church here, but we just went to church, and that's the way we believe, and Barry believes just like I do. So, and the last part of the book, not to get way ahead of myself, but you know I can't help myself, is the transcripts from a trial that Barry had to go through. And I started reading that, and I thought, man, this is going to be boring. It was anything but. I mean, it was eye-opening. It was amazing. I've been in court so many times, over 38 years as a cop. I knew what was going on in the process, although I've never heard what Barry went through, and we'll explain that here later in the interview. But this is a good one. This is one where, remember the old saying, when Morgan was still on, here's my co-host, sometimes you got to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. That's today's episode, ladies and gentlemen. So, Barry, let me stop talking here and get you going, brother. Can you tell us quickly where you grew up, what your family dynamics were? Did you play sports in high school, brothers and sisters, that kind of thing, please?
All right. Well, again, thank you for having me on, Steve. This is an honor. I grew up in a military family. Both of my parents were in the military when they met. Both of them were Navy, and they divorced in 63. Now, to understand my lineage, I have five grandparents on my father's side that came over on the Mayflower. And nearly every generation has served in the military, whether it's the Navy or the Army. My sister was the first Marine, my older sister.
Wow.
And I have three sisters and myself, so four of us total in siblings. But we grew up all over the place. I was born in Tennessee. I think you know Millington.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the installation right outside Memphis. That's where I was born. My mother and my father were stationed there when they were in the military in 62. My father had just gotten a commission. He was a Mustang, started out enlisted, and then got a commission. And he had just become a, what do they call that, an ensign? In the Navy, he had just become an ensign, and then they divorced not too long after that. And, like I said, both my parents were in the military. So I lived everywhere from Virginia, Carolina, California, all over the country during my formative years. So I got a lot of experiences in different, parts of the country, not only in the way they dress, but also in their culture of how they spoke.
Oh yeah,
you go from the deep South or the hills of Tennessee over on the east side, where my mom and all of them are from, and then you go all the way over to the West Coast to a place outside Fort Ord. It's like night and day.
I experienced that when I moved from Tennessee going into high school to West Virginia, and the kids up there made fun of my Tennessee accent. I'm thinking, have you guys listened to yourselves talk? You bunch of hillbillies. But they were accepting of me eventually. But just like you did, you learned to adapt to your new surroundings and your new circumstances so that you kind of fit in. Your kids won't fit in.
Yeah. I only played on baseball for the most part. I tried out all of them in high school and junior high and all that. But really, baseball was my passion. My grandfather pitched for the Philadelphia Athletics on my mother's side back in the day. And for you people out there that don't know who they are, they are now they were the Oakland A's. Now I think they're the Sacramento A's or the California A's or whatever.
Yeah.
And they left Philadelphia either in 50 or 51. Connie Mack was their last coach when they were the Philadelphia Athletics. And he was in the minor league with the Yankees. So I loved baseball. My mom taught me how to pitch and throw everything from a knuckleball to a spitball, nice. All that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was nice. Cool. Yeah.
You know, what I wanted to say a while ago, too, and it slipped my mind, was when we were talking about I referred to you as a hero. Heroes never refer to themselves as heroes. So that's a telltale sign right there.
Well, I appreciate that. But I'm blessed because of the people that mentored me. And the people that are around me, that's always your success. And then I'm going to add to that in my worldview, also sharing the word of God. It's important that you let people know your faith and Excellent. Where you come from.
Yep. I agree 100%. Yeah. And my regular listeners, they're used to Murph getting on his little platform here and spewing a few words out of the Bible. So
there you go.
I don't apologize for it. It's my show. And we're going to talk about things like that.
Yeah. You shouldn't. You shouldn't apologize for it.
Exactly. There's
nothing to, it's a beautiful thing.
So let's see here. Now, you went to college, but you went to the military first. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Actually, I got in some trouble there in the latter years. My mother actually had to request an assignment. We were living in Norfolk, Virginia. She was stationed there in the Army. She was out there at Fort Eustis. And I was getting in some trouble with some kids. Had to go to court when I was 13 for breaking and entering into a garage and taking some tools and a motorcycle. I was on, that all that kid that 12 and 13. I went to court on my 13th birthday. My mom bought me a brand new suit and had to have a crew cut.
Oh, geez.
And she put me in that scared straight thing. I don't know if you remember that back in the 70s. Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
I got to spend about 3 hours in one of them prisons over there outside of Norfolk. And yeah, that was the scariest day of my life.
I bet.
At that time, that was definitely the scariest day of my life. And but then she moved up and got me back out into the country. And we moved to a place called Warrenton, Virginia, which is in Fauquier County. Virginia, and I did all of my high school at a place called Fauquier County High School in Warrenton, Virginia. My mom was stationed at a place called Bent Hill Farm Station. It was a super secret squirrel installation back in the woods for the military back in them days, a small Army installation.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in my DEA career in Northern Virginia and Ashburn in that area. Very familiar with Fauquier County. So when you went to the Army, was that the judge telling you to go or mom's telling you to go?
No. I had gotten my life straight over those years when my mom got transferred up there. I did struggle with high school. I didn't like sitting in classrooms. I was still, but I worked. I worked from the time I was, before I even had a car, you worked. My mom did not make a lot of money being in the military and doing that stuff. She was enlisted. My dad did not do all of the necessary support that he should have done during that time period. My mom just did the best she could. So I worked. If I wanted something, I had to go earn it. Wow. So my first goal was to get out of the military, and I did. When you grow up and you don't have a father figure around, you revert to something.
Right.
Mine were those old black and whites or those old first color movies of John Wayne, Gary Cooper, Clark Gable, all of them. I wanted to be the guy in the sands of Iwo Jima or all of that stuff. And then when I was at Bent Hill, I met this guy. I can't remember his last name, but his first name was Billy, and he was a dear friend of my mom's and a Vietnam vet. They were having the 4th of July celebration in 78 at Bent Hill, and I had to go with my mom. So I'm 16 years old, and I'm going out here, and I go over to Billy's room. My mom meets him over there. He was living in the senior enlisted quarters. And he was going to be the keynote speaker there that day. Now, he's a Medal of Honor winner. Okay.
Nice.
And we decide we're going to walk to the parade field. And we go walking, and we pass this. I think he was a light colonel. He was either a major or a light colonel. Billy was just an E-8, master sergeant. And he didn't salute the officer. But my mom did. And the officer said, "Excuse me, Sergeant, do you know how to salute?" And he turned around. He goes, "Yes, I do. And I'm wondering why you haven't saluted me." And all of a sudden, I realized that he had the medal. I didn't realize it at the time. I'm 16 years old.
Right.
And that officer looked down at his ribbons and goes, "Oh, excuse me." And freaking popped a sharp salute. And he goes, "Have a good day, Colonel. I'll be here all day. And they went walking on. I'm like, wow. I mean, that shocked me. So I got to know him a little bit. He died a year or so later from his wounds from Vietnam. But what a great American. And so I was the recruiter's perfect pick. I walked in because I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was trying to find guidance in my life. I was in and out of the word. I'd gone to church when I was younger, but we didn't do much when we lived in Warrington. And so I was a perfect recruit. I walked into recruiter's office and saw a picture of a Ranger up there on a screen. Looked like what I envisioned Billy doing and from the movies and all. Had the patrol cap on, 120-foot rope, holding a M4. And I said, I want to do that, right, lawyer.
Well, sign right here, son.
Yeah, that's all it took. What do I got to score on this test y'all want me to take? He said a 16. You'll be fine.
Now, were you 17 or 18 at that time?
I was 17.
17. And 17. Could you go in? Could your mom sign a waiver and you go in?
Yeah, I did the delayed entry program and listed on July 17th, 1980.
Wow.
Yeah.
And as they say, the rest is history. Now, where did you go to boot camp at?
At Fort Benning.
Fort Benning, Georgia. I've been there. It's nice and cool there, isn't it, in the summertime?
No. That's why I live in Arizona now. I do not like the humidity.
Yeah, that is a it's not a very big town, but it's hot. It's always hot over there.
Yes, it is. But I was lucky. I got into the one thing I can tell you about basic that was the most perfect thing was I immediately got there and we were put in the new barracks over on Sand Hill. These things were only like a year old and they were brick and all. So they were really pretty. We thought we were living high on the hog. Well, at least for the first when we pulled up and looked at the buildings and we realized it wasn't that way.
Well, they don't want to spoil you in the Army, do they?
No, they don't. And not in those days. All of our DIs were all Vietnam vets. These guys were war heroes. These guys were just absolutely it was such a blessing to have them. It was I'll never forget. We got off the bus and they were yelling at us so fast. We were just diving out the windows of these old World War II buses. I mean, we were just throwing our bags out. They were yelling at us and we get out there and we're going along. And I had this little itty bitty short drill sergeant by the name of Staff Sergeant Davis. And I had a Staff Sergeant Cook. He was tall. All right. Now, the only relevance I'm saying on this, when it came to race, there was a little bit of racism in those days, you know, in our country. Not like there's little to none now, but there was in those days, especially from country bumpkins that came out of the woods. And Staff Sergeant Davis, he was a little short black guy, and Staff Sergeant Cook was tall white guy. And there was this tall West Virginia boy. Comes up there and there you're going up and down the line yelling and just screaming at us. And we're all trying to figure out how to stand at attention. We never had a block of instruction on how to even do that yet. and the West Virginia guy, I'm not going to say his name because he became a great American. He learned so much from this lesson, but he said, I don't take no orders from no N person. And he used the N person. I'll never forget what Davis did. Davis kicked him in the shin. He went down on his knees and then he grabbed him with the two fingers, right the lip, right below his nose. You know, that's a very tender spot.
Oh, yeah.
And he twisted it and he said, boy, you can call me whatever you want to, but let me tell you something. There's only green in the Army. Because guess what? On the battlefield, we all bleed red.
Good for him,
I was like, oh my gosh.
He thought, well, this is the first few minutes.
Yeah, this was within the first 10-15 minutes. We're still trying to get our bags lined up and being yelled at. It was crazy.
Wow. You know what? And just quickly, a little bit off topic here, but for any Vietnam veteran that's listening to this, if you were treated like crap when you came back, I apologize. I didn't do that, but I know we had a bunch of jerks who I'm guessing never served your country in any capacity whatsoever. You're nothing more than a hero because you went and served your country. I don't care what anybody else says. So if that happened to you, if you got spit on, if people talked down to you, if they looked at you like a baby killer, whatever the terms were they were using back that time, please accept our apologies. You're in our book here on Game of Crimes. You're a freaking hero. Okay.
Amen. Amen, brother.
All right. So you go. Now, how long's boot camp?
In those days, 16 weeks. That was boot camp and advanced infantry training.
And did you have any idea what you were going to be doing in the military?
Yeah, I had a contract to go to the 101st Airborne Division.
Well, I think we might have heard of them.
Yep.
And they're stationed where?
They were at Fort Campbell. But then I had this Ranger Sergeant Major about once we got into the infantry training part of it, after we had graduated from basic, and because in those days they did what is called one unit station training or one station unit training. It's where you do basic and advanced schooling for your MOS in the same location. And you have the same drill sergeants, et cetera. So we get in there and this old crusty sergeant major came in and he was recruiting and he wanted volunteers to go into Bravo Company Rangers separate. And so we're feeling all studly and stuff. You know, we're 10, 11 weeks into this. And, you know, next thing you know, I volunteered for that.
Hand, what are you doing up in the air? Get down here.
And that was probably one of the next to being saved by Jesus Christ, meeting my wife and having my wonderful kids. Best decision I ever made. Absolutely the best decision I ever made.
That's so good to hear. That's so good to hear. Probably, you know, we're supposed to have priorities in life, and the priorities, in my opinion, and I'm pretty sure in Barry's here, is God, family, job. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most of us, like, you know, this idiot here, Murph, it was job, 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 you know, and the family suffered, and my religious life suffered, my Christianity, my belief in God. Thank goodness he's forgiving. So have I still gotten it straightened out? Probably not, but I'm trying to do better.
Well, I would challenge you a little bit on that. It should be God, country, family, in my opinion, my humble opinion. And if you're following God, and if you read the commandments, one of the only commandments that actually talks about nations is commandment that says, honor your father and your mother. And if you don't, nations will fall. That's so important to understand that. And without a nation, we cannot have the harmonious place we have here in the United States where we're able to raise our families the way we believe, with the values that have been instilled in us under our Judeo-Christian lifestyle. We would be persecuted just like you see it all the time, just like Charlie Kirk was recently assassinated. He was assassinated because he spoke truth, and people need to start hearing it, and all of us need to start speaking up and talking about it. You know, you and I talked in the pre-interview a little bit, Steve, right, and we talked about honor. There's another man that displayed honor. Today most of these kids cannot define honor. I talk to college kids. I talk to ones in their 30s, and we'll get into these discussions, and they'll start talking politics and other things, worldviews, and I'll tell them, okay, let me find out where you're coming from. And the first question I always ask them, and if you go on my company website, you'll actually see it on there. It's the first value we have. It says we lead with honor. And I ask them to define honor. Every single one of them cannot define it, or they will give me the definition of integrity. They will not give me the definition of honor. And when I correct them and they go, well, what's honor? I said, honor is not doing the right thing when no one's looking. I said, that's easy to do. I said, doing the right thing no matter the cost, that's hard.
Yeah.
Because that might cost you your life. You think of it, of everybody in the military, men that lay down their lives in combat. But what about here at home? Are you willing to give up your career like Pat Tillman did? All right. Are you willing to give up your career like the father of the assassin that just killed Charlie Kirk? All right. Not only did he turn his son in, but he resigned from the police force. Jeez. I mean, think about that. He did the right thing because he knew that that would bring taint on that police force.
True.
You know, we need to start teaching our kids to hold themselves accountable to a standard of honor. You know, everybody always wants to focus nowadays in school. They teach them the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. Back when you and I went to school, before the Department of Education was created, we had to read the whole damn thing. We had to write papers on it.
Here's what I keep in my desk drawer. You saw me just pull it out. I keep a copy of the Constitution right here, right in front of me.
Yeah. Well, I have it all over the walls here and everything. And what people need to memorize, the last sentence, why did our founding fathers, the 56 that signed the Declaration of Independence, why did they do what they did? Well, they did it because if you read the very last sentence, all right, it talks about their sacred honor. And when I was growing up, my mother made me read a book called The Signers. And it was the lives of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. And 21 of them were theologians. Over a third of them, not only they were hard to capture, but the British took their wives, took their children, put them in prison, tortured them. Some of them died either in prison or after the war from their wounds. And all they had to do was sign a piece of paper saying they recanted signing their signature on the Declaration of Independence. And not one of them did it because they believed so strongly in our Lord Jesus Christ and that he had put on their heart to lead this country to a new light, to bring light to a world of darkness.
Excellent. That's setting a good standard.
It is.
Setting a high bar. That's standing up for what you believe in.
Yeah.
Now, a few years into the military, you met a young lady who is still with you today, I believe.
Yes, I did. The love of my life.
How did you miss, I think you call it, her nickname Sissy, right?
Yeah, Sissy. Yeah, wonderful woman.
How'd you guys meet?
Well, my mother passed away February 19th, 1985. I had gotten a compassionate reassignment from Europe in November of 84 due to her terminal illness with cancer. And I know your listeners, some of them may not know, but in the old days, they didn't have anything such as targeted radiation and targeted chemotherapy. They just did your whole body. And my mom was on her last leg. So I got stationed back. My mom passed away. And my sister and I, my older sister and I, my other two younger sisters, they're from my father's second marriage. We were all that was left in our mind. Our dad was not really a part of our life. So I would drive from Fort Bragg, which is where they stationed me, which was the closest duty station that I could serve in that was not far from my mother. My mother retired out of Fort Lee, Virginia, Petersburg. And so I would drive up to D.C. to see my sister. And when I was up there visiting my sister on May 26, 1985, never forget that day, wonderful day, we're going down to a pool. It was a Sunday. And I had a towel over there wearing a pair of Ranger skivvy PT shorts, a pair of sunglasses, looked like an aviator sunglasses. And I was heading down to the pool. And my sister, I was waiting there at the bottom of the elevators for my sister. And these two tiny women, my wife, 5'1", and her roommate, Debbie, was 4'9". They're trying to carry this big, huge box. And it looked like it weighed a ton, and it did, through these sets of double glass doors into this huge condominium that was like 20 stories high, right off of Route 1 and 495 that go around D.C., all right, and trying to carry through these double glass doors. And I said, ladies, can I help you with that? And what I find out is it's a bookshelf, a pressed wood bookshelf. And y'all, everybody out there that's ever lived pressed wood, that's some heavy stuff.
It is.
They go, yes, we sure could. So I go over there, big muscles, they get it on the elevator, take it all the way up for them. And it was a new bookcase for their apartment. They were roommates. And I get done, and they give me a Coors Light. And I'm thinking about her. I mean, she's on my mind. And the reality is when she came walking through those doors, there was a halo over her head, and God was telling me, you need to meet her. And that's when I tell her, she goes, oh, you're so full of it. And I said, yeah, yeah.
Well, wait, wait, we must be married to sisters. I hear that all the time too.
So I go back up, and I got to get ready to go back to Bragg because it's a Sunday. And it's a good 2-3 hour drive in them days because you had to do 55 miles an hour. Well, that's if you did 55 miles an hour, but you get the point.
Yeah, got it.
And I'm sitting there, I'm watching, I'll never forget this, she wore yellow ribbon. And I'm watching those two young lieutenants fighting over meeting this girl. And I'm like, I'm going to be in this contest. So I freaking get done getting my stuff on, and I go down and knock on her door and asked her out the next weekend. And we dated over the next 6 weekends. I saw her 5 of those weekends, and I asked her to marry me on July 4th, 1985. We got married on August 24th, 1985, and we've been together ever since.
40 years later.
Yep.
Congratulations. You know, it's funny because when I tell people, when I do speaking events and tell people that my wife and I have been married 41 years, they always applaud. And I never quite understand that, other than I guess they respect the sanctity of marriage and the fact that, you know, you've made it this far, because this is number 2 for me. My practice wife didn't last too long.
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. But see, these young folks today, they think that marriage is, ooh, this little feeling I'm going to have. No. If you ever read the Bible and even some other love stories, love is an action word. It's not a feeling. If you really care for someone, then you're going to take action and to show them that you care for them by the things you do, how you treat them, how you treat their family, your friends, everything.
Nice.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
All right. Not to go too deep in your military career, but just give us the Reader's Digest of everywhere you were stationed in your military career.
Oh, my gosh.
If you can.
All right. I was stationed. Yes, I can. Reader's Digest version. I was stationed in Europe, in the DMZ in Korea. Central America, did a lot of missions down there. Most of my time were, once I was married, I literally only lived in 3 places with my family, even though I was in multiple assignments or multiple positions in those locations, my family was able to stay at those locations.
Nice.
So yeah, that was good. So while I was married, I was at Bragg, I was in the 82nd. But 4 months later, after I was married, the Army under Reagan was standing up a new division, the 10th Mountain Division. Mm-hmm. And I was selected by Department of the Army as a non-commissioned officer, ranger, to go down and start that unit up. So I was getting sent back to Fort Benning because that's where the brigade that I was assigned to was standing up at. Fort Benning, Georgia. So I got moved to Fort Benning, where I stood up the 10th Mountain Division. I was a scout squad leader there. And then I was selected by Command Sergeant Major Donald Purdy, one of my heroes, one of my great mentors of life, and a dear friend of mine today, a Vietnam vet, and to be a ranger instructor. So then I went over there, and then I stood up that was the 4th Ranger Training Battalion, and also the 3rd Ranger Company back when I first joined it. And then You already heard I was in Benning before at Bravo Company Rangers when I first came in, which was a separate company and worked independently of the rest of the Army. And then in Europe, I was an 11-man Pathfinder detachment. Then in the Ranger Department, or Ranger School, they decided to add a desert phase. So I was they started sending me to Dugway, Utah, and I stood up the 7th Ranger Training Battalion out in Dugway Proving Ground, Utah, in the latter 80s. The really cool thing was when I was an RI at Fort Benning in the 4th Ranger Training Battalion, I actually got to train the DEA, which we found out you were part of.
Yep.
Which was very cool when they were doing those drug cartel missions down in Central America. We would set up little villages and stuff to train them on. It was really awesome.
Yeah, I think that was the Operation Snowcaps, what they called it back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Then after the invasion of Panama, I got a commission to become an officer and went from sergeant first class to second lieutenant. Then I went to Korea. The DMZ, as I shared earlier, I was there for 19 months. I served up in the DMZ as a platoon leader, and then I was the executive officer, operations officer, and commander of the LERSH unit over there as well for 2ID. And then I came back to Fort Benning again had to get my MEC time, as the Army called it as an officer, my mechanized infantry time. And I did a year at that at Fort Benning. And then I got stationed at Fort Campbell. I finally got to Fort Campbell 15 years later. In 95, I get to Fort Campbell, and I commanded two units there. This company right here, Charlie Company 3rd and the 327th, and then the LERSH unit, that guide on right up there, their Ranger company, LERP or LERSH units. Have you ever heard of LERP or LERSH units?
I've heard of the LERP units.
Yeah, LERP. Well, they changed the name in the 80s to LERSH units. They changed them from long range recon patrol to long range surveillance units. They were all Ranger units as well. And then, so I commanded that unit. And then after that, I was supposed to go to West Point and teach. Under the Clinton drawdown, they deleted the orders. And I got stuck in an assignment, a remote assignment in Mississippi, training the National Guard in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and East Texas as an active duty person. And I came out on a list for major, and I prayed on it, thought on it a long time, because while I was there in Mississippi, I got saved. I started getting my life right with God and realized that God wanted me to go to a different direction. And I said, nope, dropped my retirement papers and retired from the military.
Wow. Well, now somewhere in that 21 years, you got your college education, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. I got both my undergraduate and my graduate degree.
How in the world did you fit that in with everything else you got, traveling around the world and training and trying to keep a family? And
good question. Funny story. I had no desire to become an officer because I didn't think I was good at school. All right. And so I get stationed at 10th Mountain. Like I told you earlier, this is the end of 85, beginning of 86. And about 8-9 months into it, I'm coming up for reenlistment. And they're offering this new package where you can go to college for a full quarter or semester, and all you have to do is keep up your qualification and your PT. And it was a reenlistment incentive, and you had to reenlist for a minimum of 4 to 6 years to get it. And I'm like, let me check this out, because I met this officer who was a captain. He was the artillery officer in our battalion. Mm-hmm. Really, really nice guy. And he had 2 master's degrees. All right. But let me tell you something. This guy had no common sense. He could tell you the dimensions and the internal workings of a doorknob, but he could not tell you how to turn that damn doorknob. And I'm like, if this guy's got 2 master's degrees, and I'm a rocket scientist. So my wife and my dad was on me, because I tried to rebuild my relationship with my dad, which has been successful. And he was a college graduate. He said, go try it, do it. And my wife was pushing me to do it. So I went to school, and I was shocked. I'm 24 years old, 25 at the time. What was I? Tell you, let's see, 62 was I? Yeah, 24, 25 at the time. And I walk into the classroom at Chattahoochee Community College, right? Taking my first classes in English and, you know, history, all that stuff. And I walk in there, I got books and paper. I'm ready to go. Military discipline. Nobody else in that entire room was ready for school. All of them were right out of high school. They're just sitting around. They look like they're hungover. I got straight A's through that whole thing. I'm like, this thing ain't that hard. I was just lacking the discipline when I was younger to focus on what was important. Right. And that's when I realized this college thing is not that hard. It's just a question of I was not ready at the time when I was graduating from high school. And so I just carried my books to the field the rest of the time. I always talked to my professors. If the professor wouldn't allow me to miss classes, then I would change schools or not take them. Mm-hmm. You know, but I carried my books to the field. I always got my assignments done on time, et cetera.
Yeah. Good for you. I mean, that's seeing a mission and carrying it through. And yeah. So you got your, I think you told me you got your undergrad at Troy University and you got your master's at William Carey University. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Good for you, brother. I mean, you never know when the education is going to come later in life to help you out. It's more than a piece of paper.
Yeah. And in everybody's journey, God, you know, I call it people's walk with God. You know, we all come to realizations at our own pace. The question is, are you going to be, and anybody you run into, are you going to be a hindrance to that? Or are you going to be a mentor to that? And I, you know, and I remember back all the leaders that I had, Purdy, Max Mullins, George Ponder, Ralph Beam, all these brothers in arms, they were all mentors to me. And I try to do the same thing and move that forward, whether it's mentoring young boys in our church or just people that I run into. It's a beautiful
Excellent.
Thing.
Well, so when you came out of the military, and this is, now we're talking, what, 2001, 2002?
Mm-hmm. 2001, April 1st.
Where did you, what did you have in, did you have anything in mind?
Well, it was sort of a shock to my family when I decided to retire. I mean, it was a real shock because I was the warrior's warrior. Prior to getting saved in 2000, I was the meanest snake you ever want to meet. All right. God was not in my life. All right. It was Army, Army, Army. Yeah. And, I was a hard father. The lessons were good, but there were times that I should have slowed down more and done a little bit more I love you and not so much more of the kicking in the butt, as an Army Ranger. And that's a lesson I've learned, through the years. But with that, I knew I wanted to be a financial advisor, but we didn't have the money to move from this remote assignment on my retirement, buy a house, and start a business as a financial advisor. So I interviewed with, went to one of those headhunter groups that were real popular in that day. They would set up seminars at these big hotels and all. I went to one of them for officers coming out of the military because, you know, that was during Clinton's drawdown. That was a real big thing because they went from having 12 divisions down to 10 divisions. And so I went to one of these headhunter groups. I interviewed with 14 companies over 2 days and got 9 offers. The only one that had military installations next to them for me to become a financial advisor at First Command, which was a company I wanted to go with, was Yuma, Arizona. My wife's like, oh, this could be an adventure. We're going to be west of the Mississippi. I always wanted to move outside the Southeast, you know, da 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 da. And she goes, how long have you been? I don't know, 5-6 years. Well, that's 24 years ago. And we're still here.
So math wasn't your major.
not in that case. No.
In that company, what's your role? Because I mean, your background is military. So what are you doing in this new financial company?
There, I was a financial advisor as well. After I did that 1 year with that company that hired me, I stepped off and went to work for First Command as a financial advisor. That company that hired me was called RMH, and they brought me in here to be a GM of a new facility that had about 350 people in it. And I did that literally for 1 year and 2 weeks and then walked out the door. And I gave them my notice and stepped off and took the stock options that I had and used it to front my business. in the financial services world with First Command.
And who were your primary clients in First Command?
At those days, it was 100% military, E6 and above.
And I knew the answer to that. I just love it. I love the fact that you're continuing to support your military brothers and sisters in arms.
Yeah. And well, what I realized once I got in there was I was just a glorified salesman. That's all I was. Yeah. I was just a glorified salesman selling mutual funds and whole life insurance. And after about, they gave me 39 clients when I moved into this office out here. And by the time I left, just under 6 years later, I had over 400. Yeah, it's crazy. It's absurd. And it's, they want you to guarantee lifetime service, but then they give you hundreds and hundreds, and it's impossible to do. The math just doesn't add up for you to take care of these people and stay on top of everything. I was going to leave the industry. I was offered a lot of money to go to New York Life because I can sell. I could sell a blind man contacts, but that's not why I became a financial advisor. That's not why I got the degrees I got. That's not why I learned that money is a commodity, and it's to help you identify what your values are and help you accomplish your goals for the reasons that are important to you, nobody else. New York Life offered me a huge sum of money to leave and come to them. And so I went to my leaders and I said, let's do this. And they said, yeah, let's do it. Cause I was their number one advisor internationally in Yuma, Arizona that year. We don't want to lose you. And I said, okay, well, we got to change. That's what I told them. We got to change because this makes no sense. And they said, okay, will you do a beta test and write it for us? And at that time they were going through a lot of struggles with the Financial Regulatory Authority, FINRA, and the Securities and Exchange Commission for what they called fraudulent sales practices. They agreed. And so I got a group of clients together and learned what they really wanted. I didn't write the model in some funnel without talking to the clients. The clients are the number one driver in our firm. And we stepped off. But then after they got through all that legal stuff, I was still going through the beta test and then went back with my results. And they said, oh, yeah, we appreciate you doing this, but we're not going to go there. Oh, and by the way, we're going to cut your pay, even though I had signed a separate agreement that mine would stay at a certain level. And I said, well, I'm not accepting that. And then they terminated me without cause.
Wow.
But all the clients that had come into the new world under the beta test all left with me.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And that resulted in what?
It resulted in fee only financial advisory firm that we have now, headquartered in Yuma. We have offices from Virginia to California.
And that's the name of your company now is Invicta Financial Group.
Yep. Invicta Financial Group. Yep.
Just out of curiosity, what's Invicta? What does that mean?
That means unconquered.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
Latin for unconquered. I love Latin. Latin's a beautiful language.
You know, my dad was a Southern Baptist minister. And when he went to seminary, he had to take Latin and he spoke Latin. I don't know what he was saying to me. He was probably wondering, what the heck did I do to deserve this kid?
Yeah. My mother spoke five languages and she did the same thing. Yeah. She spoke Latin, Spanish, English, Arabic, and Vietnamese.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Smart woman.
That's very impressive. All right. So your company is doing pretty well. You're successful.
Yes.
And then we roll around to 2014. And in February, on February 28th, you and your bride and I think some friends went out to have a nice evening together. Let's start talking about that because that's the reason that you're here.
Okay. Well, to put it in a nutshell, just to bring your listeners and viewers up to speed on what happened here.
Right.
My wife and I were out with some friends. Then we were threatened, and then I was attacked not once, but twice by two men, one wielding a knife. And after defending myself and the police arrive, I was arrested and charged without any investigation or due process. And it took me through literally over 26 months of hell to get through it. And then another 5.5 years to clear my name and get the whole record sealed in somewhere between $600,000 and $750,000 in legal fees and costs. So that's it in a nutshell. But when you read the story, what I realized through this whole thing was you're no longer innocent until proven guilty. In this country, you are now presumed guilty. And anybody that's been in that position where it's been presumed you were guilty, it's absurd. It's absurd. And thank God for a court, and a judge that knew and had respect for the law, because the incompetence of the police detective that was on my case and the malicious prosecution of the prosecutor, if they had had a judge on their side that did not have that respect for the law, I would have been thrown under the jail.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and I'm going to dig down into it just a little bit. One thing that, and he's giving you an overview, ladies and gentlemen, but we want to talk a little bit more in detail about this. And you got to understand that this was all videotaped. The police officers had access to the videotape and didn't review it before they put Barry in jail. I'm glad you're laughing. I know it's ridiculous the way it happened, but you don't have to be an experienced detective to figure out, yeah, let's take a look at, you know, I had a prosecutor in Miami tell me one time, and it hurt my feelings. Like, you regular listeners have heard me mention this before. The best evidence that you could have, I always thought, was, hey, I'm an honest cop. I've been a cop my whole life. I've been a cop more years than I've been anything else, including my childhood. But I thought I was the best evidence. And he said, no. The best evidence is video. Second best is audio. Third best is your testimony. And that hurt my feelings because I thought I was God's gift to law enforcement, you know. So it's amazing that I retired and law enforcement continues to go on without me, but they do. But it's kind of ridiculous.
I'm surprised the Ranger community continues to go on without me.
Understood, brother. Understood. But here's, you know, I mean, this is just, we had a pre-call about a week ago, Barry and I did, and we're talking, and I'm thinking, here's an established businessman who's a U.S. Army veteran who's never been charged with, I don't know if you ever had a speeding ticket, but I'm pretty sure you've never been charged with a felony.
Nope.
You know, so you got a clean record. They know where he lives. They know where he works. He's not a flight risk. There's no reason to charge him immediately when you can conduct your investigation, because right now it's he said, she said, although there's a video, which might help you figure this out, but they didn't bother to look at that video for quite some time. So, and you're very open and transparent in your book where you talk about the words that you exchanged with him because of the things that he was saying to you and what he wanted you to do, which was kind of asinine. And so it sounds like it was just straight out ego, personality, vindictiveness towards you, because I'm assuming I presume that he interpreted your comments as a personal assault on him. Well, we got a thing called the First Amendment. We're allowed to say things.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, at that moment, those words you're talking about, that was a personal assault on him, because what he said to me, and for your listeners, 100% of what is in this book comes from the transcripts, the audio recordings, and the videos. There is nothing in here that is exaggerated at all. The only thing that has been changed is some of the names, because I asked for people to sign waivers for me to use their real name. If they didn't sign a waiver, then mm-hmm. I went ahead and changed those names.
Right.
Right. And then in the transcripts from the preliminary hearing and the last about a 35% of the book, 6 of the 14 chapters have the transcripts from the preliminary hearing. There were some things that were typed, and we corrected those misspellings. But right. We did not change any of how the people talked, what they said. If they misspoke, those are in there. And we did that on purpose to make sure that everybody understands what's happening here. And that was a personal insult to him, because his incompetence stood out beyond comprehension. And ladies and gentlemen, this is the first night I'm brought in. The police arrive. They don't read me my rights. They handcuff me. They put me in the back of a car, take me down to an interview room. The first thing I do is I start praying. And then I'm sitting there and I'm praying. The police officer, the detective, after I'm done praying, a few minutes after I'm done praying, he comes in and he wants to know what happened. And at first I didn't want to tell him, and then I decided I would, because I had nothing to hide. I knew I had followed the law. I had my CCW license at that time in about 39 states. I knew the laws of Arizona. It was my home. And so I brought him in and I told him what happened. I love it. You always got both sides in the TV, on TV, where the police say, yeah, tell us the truth and it'll help you. We'll help you. Da, 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 da. Well, in this case, I told him the truth thinking that, and that wasn't the case. And then after I was done, he came in and he said to me, he goes, sign this document, read this document and sign it. And I said, what is it? He says, it's a charge sheet. And I said, I'm being charged. What am I being charged with? He goes, attempted murder, 2 counts of aggravated assault. I said, I told you it was strictly self-defense. He goes, we have the whole thing on video. I said, great. Have you looked at the video? His exact words to me, folks, were not yet. I'm like, your listeners have been listening to this. They know I was a ranger instructor and I was an NCO for many years. And I love the NCO, but that drill sergeant ranger instructor mentality shot the blood up to my brain and engaged my mouth. And I literally said some things that weren't great to him, but, it was,
if you want to know what that is, it's in the book. As I read it in the book.
So it probably made you laugh, though, didn't it?
It did. It did. I'm like, well, hey, you asked for that one.
I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
There's and God bless law enforcement. We're not here bashing anybody. You folks know me that listen to this show all the time. I bleed blue. I will until the day I die. And this is not about bashing the cops. But when you take that oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, you're taking an oath to protect your fellow man. You got to live up to it. That's why it's called an oath. You can't just pick and choose. If you're having a bad day, if you and your wife are fighting, you can't let those outside events influence what you're supposed to be doing. Because being a cop, the authorities that you have are some of the most Barry? It's some of the most empowered abilities that anybody can legally have.
Yes. You have all the power.
You're authorized to kill somebody if you have to protect another person. I can't imagine anything stronger than that.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what disappointed me the most through this whole thing. And I talk about it a little bit in my book. And going back to that word honor I talked about earlier, in the military, the men that mentored me and that led me beat this into my skull, honor. And so I knew 3 or 4 of the police officers that were on the Yuma Police Department. And my attorney and lead detective reached out to them after we got the video from the police, had it forensically enhanced by Brian Neumeister, one of the FBI's leading video forensics experts that lives in Phoenix. He took 160 hours of video, condensed it down into the cameras that were from 16 different cameras, condensed it down into a movie, and brought those in. Yeah, that cost me a lot of money. These police officers, and every single one of them, well, one of them refused to come in and see it. The other 3 came in and looked at it and they said, oh, you're right, man. You got a good case here. Da, 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 da. When my attorney asked them to write a professional statement on what they see in the video, every single one of them, to a man, said, I can't do that. I cannot go against my brothers in blue.
I do understand that, but I don't understand it.
That feeling that these men did not know what honor is in the military. If I did that, I would be thrown in jail. All right. If I knew anything about any subject and I failed to do the right thing, I would be crushed for it, at least when I was in. And so that hurt. That really hurt. And I want your listeners to understand, because I'm sure you have a lot of police officers across the nation that listen to you. I trust the police, all right? But now I'm much more skeptical than I was before. I'm much more hesitant in what I say until I get to know the person.
Right. And yeah. You never went to prison, so I'm assuming you don't run around with criminals.
No,
I think that's a pretty safe assumption here.
At the time I was arrested, I owned two companies.
Wow.
Well, yeah. I'm like, really?
Yeah. And what I was going to say is the prisons, not the jails, the prisons are full of people who say they didn't do it. Now, we're learning as we go through new technology, especially through DNA examinations and analysis, that a lot of those people are telling the truth.
Yeah.
But when you've got people who, without question, are committing violent crimes against their fellow man, whether it's murder, robbery, torture, human trafficking, whatever, and if you know they're the ones that did it, they know they're the ones that did it, but then they say, I'm not guilty. That's what taints everybody else. And it taints everybody on the outside to think, no, you did do it, but you're lying about it. So then, it's easy to stereotype any group. Like it would be easy for Barry here to stereotype every police officer in the world now because of his negative experience, but he's not doing that.
No, I'm not. And you got to look at the whole incident. One of the couples that was there that night, they're a retired military couple, Tony and Dawn, and she worked for me. But her husband, retired Marine, great American, loved him to death. He actually, him and his wife sort of meandered out there in the second attack. And he wasn't out there for the whole thing, but he meandered out there in the second attack. And on his statement to the police, he made himself out to be the hero, right? Because he was looking at things through his own prism, right? A very narrow prism, right? He had went over and did first aid on the young man that got shot. He was trying to get the weapon from me and calm me down. All this kind of stuff he put in his statement to the police. But in the video, this is him behind his wife. Let's say his wife's here. His wife's right here, and he's right here.
Oh, you're kidding.
Nope.
Whoa.
Yeah. But, I mean, it doesn't make him a bad man. He was intoxicated, we all see things through our own lens. And depending on where our ego's at, we have a tendency to exaggerate what we see or what we think we saw. And the other thing I learned, I did not know this, Steve, I did not know that eyewitness testimony is only 25% accurate. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's hard to find two people that will explain a situation this exact same. I mean, it's like almost unheard of.
Yeah. Yeah, I was totally shocked by that. When my attorney told me that, I said, well, thank God. Because when I told him what happened, and then he got the videos, and then he watched it after the FBI got done running his camera. He actually called me in. He goes, I can't believe this, Barry. He goes, 80% of what you told me is accurate. Wow. He goes, I've never seen that.
Yeah. I guess it's the way we're brought up. It's the anxiety or the stress or how you can handle that at the time that the incident's taking place. It could be, if it's witnesses, it's from the different angles they're seeing things. How much do they know about what started this and how it escalated along? Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Remember, there was an old trick when I was in junior high or high school that a teacher would pull, and they would line, say, 10, 15 students up, and she would tell the first student a story. And then that student had to relay it, and every student had to relay it to the person next to them. By the time it got to the end, it wasn't anywhere near what that thing started
out. Exactly. It's always that way because we all interpret things the way we hear it, and then we flip it into what we want to say to emphasize our points.
Yeah.
And it ends up getting totally convoluted by the time you get to the end.
You know, and many times too, I don't think it's people intentionally lying. I think it's just their interpretation, the way they saw it. And you know, after thinking about it, our memories are fleeting. It really is. That's why when you're having done it myself, you want to get statements from people as quickly as you can, because they're going to forget or they're going to overthink it. And then they're going to start adding things or taking away from the facts.
Yeah. Every one of them said I pointed the weapon at it.
You never did.
No, I never did. Never did. But what they saw was my finger go up, and they made a assumption that the weapon was in my hand after I had been attacked.
Which the video showed, because I read the book, the video showed that you didn't.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I tell you what, Barry, we've been going a little over an hour now. So what I'd like to do, let's call an end to today's interview. Barry has agreed to come back again for tomorrow's episode. You guys know I always try to divide these up into two episodes, so don't want to inundate you with too much information at one time. But we're going to get into more of what actually took place, what he went through. We want to talk about the stand your ground laws in Arizona, as well as you folks know I'm in Florida, and we're kind of famous for our stand your ground laws here. And we'll get into all that and then come back tomorrow. But thank you so much for joining us again. Couldn't do any of this that we do here on Game of Crimes without your support. So in the meantime, God bless. We'll see you tomorrow.